We're considering the wise men and the Star of Bethlehem. The first point that we want to look at, wise men from the east. Now, the whole episode of the wise men is quite bizarre in many different respects. So we read about these wise men who come, and they're not Jewish. They come from a far-off land. They come to worship this king. And you have to ask the question, well, why are they doing this? And I want to just kind of consider that a little bit. But they're usually depicted as three riding camels with three gifts, and their names have been added to the story as the years have gone by, even though they're not mentioned here, and they're identified as being kings. Now, the truth is, there were three gifts. I don't know if they were riding camels. I don't know if they were kings, and I don't know if there were three. My guess is that there were more than three, that you have this entourage of wise men who are coming from the east. And that's one of the reasons why Herod is, and not just Herod, but you know, all the people of the city there are upset. They're nervous about what is happening, this entrance of these wise men from this other empire. Now, apart from the Roman Empire, the next largest empire of that time was the Parthian Empire. And there were wars that broke out along the borderlands between the Roman Empire and the Parthian Empire, which would have been around, you know, where Babylon and, you know, that area of the land. So when they hear this, if you look at verse 3, it says, "When Herod heard that the wise men had come, they were troubled in all Jerusalem with him." And I can imagine he might have thought, well, is this another excuse on their part to, you know, to fight? Again, are they coming to cause trouble? Now, we quickly move past that. Herod doesn't know at the time, but we see why they have come. But this still is upsetting to the people and to Herod, of course, who is just obsessed with his reigning in the land there. But so you have these wise men. Now, the word is magi or magos is the word that is used to describe who they were. And this is not a word that is used just to describe them. So, for example, there's another passage of Scripture in the New Testament that uses the exact same word as the magi. And it is found in Acts chapter 13, verses 6 through 8. So it says, "Now when they had gone through the island to Paphos, they found a certain sorcerer, a false prophet, a Jew, whose name was Bar-Jesus, who was the proconsul, Sergius Paulus, an intelligent man. This man called for Barnabas and Saul and sought to hear the word of God." Verse 8. "But Elymas the sorcerer," for so his name is translated, "withstood them, seeking to turn the proconsul away from the faith." Now, does anybody want to hazard a guess? Which word is translated from the word magos in the Greek? You want to hazard a guess? It appears once here, and it appears once here in this verse. Anybody want to take a shot at it? Sorcerer. Now, the word sorcerer is the exact same word that is translated for the wise men in our passage. So why is it translated sorcerer here in Acts, but wise men back in Matthew chapter 2? What's the difference? Well, the difference is when you read about the wise men, well, they're pretty positive, right? So we don't want to call them sorcerers because they're positive characters, whereas Elymas in the Acts passage is a bad guy. And so the word is translated like it would normally be translated, as sorcerer. Now, the word sorcerer and the like, witches and sorcery and, you know, all of that magic kind of stuff is condemned in Scripture. There is no affirmation of the occult. The occult is something that Christians should reject and stay away from. And so all of the verses in Scripture, except when it describes these magi, is negative. So we come to these wise men, and it translates this word that is typically associated with the occult in a positive way, because again, in this account, and I don't think that's wrong, because in this account, they are positive characters. They're not, you know, exercising their wears in order, you know, for bad or for evil. They are the good guys in this account. Now, they weren't Jewish, and they're not a part of the nation of Israel. And so we might say, I mean, if they're not a part of the nation of Israel, we might say they weren't believers, so to speak. And yet, they're coming to Israel in order to look for the king of the Jews who had been born there. Now, why would they be coming to look for the king of the Jews? Why would these people from another nation, another empire, far away, why would they come to Israel, to Jerusalem, looking for the king of the Jews? Now, I believe the answer to this is goes all the way back to Daniel. You remember Daniel? He was taken captive like 500 years before the events of the birth of Jesus. 500 to 600 years. He's taken captive along with many of the people of Israel. The Babylonians had come. They had conquered the southern kingdom of Judah and carried them away. There were three deportations. They're carried away to Babylon. Now, when the people of Israel returned back to Jerusalem in order to rebuild it, not everybody left Babylon and came back. As a matter of fact, Daniel probably stayed there, and there was a strong community. Now, we read about Daniel in the book of Daniel and how God had elevated him to this prominent position, not only when Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonians were ruling, but also when the Medes and the Persians, when Darius was ruling, he was elevated to a place, a prominent place. And we know that Daniel honored God, right? That's clear. He honored God. And he issued these prophecies. God spoke to him and he revealed these prophecies. And in his prophecies, more than once, he prophesies of a coming king. And the king that Daniel prophesied would come is not a king just for the king of the Jews, but a king of the what? The whole world. And so we read, and here's just one example in the book of Daniel. Daniel chapter 9, verse 25. It says, "Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the command to restore and build Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince, there shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. The street shall be built again and the wall, even in troublesome times." So this is one of the verses in Daniel where he is prophesying not only concerning Judah or Jerusalem, but he is prophesying concerning the nations of the world. And he is running the course in his prophecies that culminates in the coming of this great king, this Messiah. The word is actually used here in the book of Daniel. So with prophecies like this, there is an anticipation there in Babylon, and of course it gets inscripturated and becomes part of our Bible, but there is the anticipation of a coming Messiah, a coming king over there in Babylon. Now, 500 years pass, and there is this providential preservation of the prophecies that Daniel had given. And I think his influence and his impact was so great on the astrologers and the sorcerers of Babylon that they are looking for the signs of this king when he should be born and when the things Daniel talked about would be fulfilled. So Daniel wasn't just talking about a king of Israel. He was talking about a king that would rise out of Israel, that would come from God, he would be from God, and he would rule the entire world. And so they're looking for this prophecy, they're looking for the king of the Jews, and they come to Jerusalem, the center of Israel, looking for the king that had been born, because they saw his star, his sign, in the sky. They came to worship him. And it says that he was, let's see, well, that's what it says in verse 1. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem, saying, "Where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we have seen his star in the east and have come to worship him." So they come to worship him. Now, before we go on and move away from these wise men here, I want to consider one more thing about where the wise men are going in order to worship Jesus. There are some clues in this passage as to where the wise men went, where they went in order to worship Jesus. It is typically depicted as them going to the stable where he's still laying in the manger, having just been born, and they worship him there, bringing in, you know, the three wise men, bringing their three gifts in. But there are some clues here, I think, that point to something a little bit different than this. So some time passes after the birth of Jesus. It is described for us at the end of chapter 1. So we move to chapter 2. This is after, when Jesus was born there, the wise men are coming. Now, when the wise men go into Herod, he is troubled with all Jerusalem. He calls them in, and he wants to know, in verse 4 it says, "And when he had gathered all the chief priests and scribes of the people together, he inquired of them where the Christ was to be born. And Herod called the wise men," in verse 7, and look what he asks them. He wants to know when the star appeared. When did this star appear? That's what he wants to know of the wise men. When did you see this star first? Now, Herod is making this, he's presenting himself as, well, I want to go worship him also. But he's, you know, when did you see this? When did you see the star? Now, why do you think he's asking, when did you see this star?
So he could probably determine when Jesus was born.
We know what he does, right? He is so intent on destroying this Messiah that he issues a command for all of the babies 2 years old and under to be killed. Now, why 2 years old? Well, he wants to make sure, given what the wise men said about when they saw the star, he wants to make sure that the baby is killed. Now, 2 years would mean that there's a little bit of a cushion from what they told Herod when they saw the star to this, well, just get all of the two-year-olds and under. That way we'll be sure to get him. So it wasn't like a last week kind of thing or, 2 weeks ago. It was probably, one and a half year kind of thing. And so Herod issues this two-year-old, kill them all from 2 years old and younger. In verses 9 and 11, it says, "When they heard the king, they departed, and behold, the star which they had seen in the east went before them till it came and stood over where the young child was." Not the baby or the infant, but the young child. And so there is this passing of time, this age for Jesus. He's not a baby anymore. Verse 11 says the same thing. "When they had come into the house, they saw the young child," there it is again, "with Mary his mother, and fell down and worshipped him." So Jesus is no longer an infant, and he's not in the manger anymore. Where is he? Verse 11 says, "When they had come into the house." So Joseph and Mary and Jesus, they had gone to Bethlehem by the edict of the king in order to sign up for the census. Well, she's pregnant. There's no room in the inn. They go to the manger. They have the baby, and they stay in Bethlehem for a period of time. And they're living in a house there. So here come the wise men. Time has passed from the birth of Jesus. They're still pursuing the king. They go, they find him. He is not 2 years old yet, but he is older than the infant of the manger, and he is in a house. They find him, and they worship him. So that's the wise men. Any questions or thoughts or stones to throw or tomatoes or anything? Yeah, this is so different from how it's depicted. You know, we don't. I got Tyson first. Tyson.
I just don't want to overlook verse 4.
Uh huh.
Just because these guys knew, they had the data, they had the scriptures.
Yeah.
And they knew that this was going to happen.
Yeah. Hold on to that thought.
Validation of the wise men coming in, validating the scriptures.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely. It's amazing. So we'll get to that on my last point there. But if I don't quite get what you're getting at, bring it up again. But I think we're going there. Anthony?
All right. So the wise men weren't there when Jesus was born.
Right.
Oh, okay. No. Okay.
All right. Yeah. It's later. So it's still a great thing. I mean, for this group of wise men to come into Jerusalem, where is the King of the Jews? That's pretty fantastic. The shepherds were there. Yes, the shepherds were there, which is another great testimony. Right. All right. Okay. Good. Any others? Questions? Thoughts? Yeah.
They walk into Herod's palace.
Yeah.
All Jerusalem is in an uproar because it's obviously a very large caravan just for safety purposes.
Yeah.
And he said, okay, where's the king? Wait a minute. Herod says, wait a minute, I'm the king. What do you mean looking for the king? Well, we saw this astrological event. When did you see this?
Yeah.
Oh, this happened X amount of years ago. They're probably coming again. If you're coming from Babylon, it's a year at least on camelback or caravan wise. And again, you have, if you're carrying that much loot, you definitely have the security entourage. And again, they're of some status, so they can control these things.
Yeah.
And it would be no different than 12 limousines driving into downtown Martinsburg. Who in the world is this, and what's going on here?
Right. Yeah, it was a big deal. Their presence was felt. They didn't come in secret. And they were pretty bold. They went right up to the king. Where's the king of the Jews been born? You know, that's a pretty bold request.
That Herod's not it.
Yeah.
So Herod's like, wait a minute.
Well, he knows. And this goes into what Tyson started to ask. So we'll come right back to that because it's pretty fascinating. All right. All right. Any other chemical? Yeah.
Herod have been able to see the star of Bethlehem?
Now, that's an interesting question, and my answer would be no. And we'll go into that in a second, yeah, as to why not. All right, anybody else? All right, so that brings us to the Star of Bethlehem, as it is typically called. Now, what was this star? I think that there are two kind of ideas or theories as to what the star was. First of all, the Star of Bethlehem was this appearance of some kind of constellation or alignment of the planets or something that was unique or different that stood out. And the wise men, being astrologers, looking at the stars and knowing their movements, they saw something there that was unique. Something that they had learned and pointed them to, or connected them to something that, you know, going back to Daniel and so on and so forth. So that's one theory. Another theory is that in the Bible, stars and angels are often associated. So when the Bible talks about the hosts of the heavens or the heavenly hosts, it could be talking about the stars, or it could be talking about the armies of the Lord, the angels. And so that would be the second thing. So first of all, if we refer to the stars of the sky, when we consider this, God did an amazing thing. So let's look at some verses real quick. First of all, you have Genesis chapter 1, verse 16, and we're familiar with this. Then God made two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night. He made the stars also. So this is referring to the heavenly bodies, the stars, the sun, the moon, and so on. So God is the creator of these things. In Job chapter 9, verses 8 and 9, it says, He, God alone, spreads out the heavens and treads on the waves. He made the Bear, Orion, and Pleiades, and the chambers of the south. So we have three constellations named. And the only one I can pick out is Orion. Anybody with me on that? Anybody? You can pick out the Big Dipper? All right, I might be able to pick out the Big Dipper. But Orion, whenever I look up, that's what I'm looking for. It just, to me, it just stands out among the rest. God is the one who put that constellation there, and it's pretty amazing. I have an app, actually, on my iPad. I can point it up anywhere, and it'll show me what's there. I mean, even on the other side of the earth, I can just point it anywhere. I love the app. I don't use it that often, but I want to pull it out. And, you know, what's that bright star there this morning? I can just point it, and it'll tell me it's either Jupiter, or maybe sometimes it's Saturn, and I'm just like, whoa, this is so fascinating. All right, anyway, there was this guy years ago. He brought this program. It's a computer program of the constellations of the stars. And basically, with the software, you can put in any date in history, and it brings up the sky, what the stars, where they were, what the position was. He goes through this, and it's really fascinating. I don't agree completely with everything, but I just love this video. He goes back and, you know, accounting for leap years and all of these things. He goes back to the time of Jesus, and he shows how Jupiter, and that's what he thinks this star is that they saw. He shows how Jupiter goes and then comes back, and it just kind of comes to a particular point, and he thinks that that's what the wise men saw. You know. Anyway, I'm not explaining it so good, but it's just fascinating. But it's based on the fact that God is the one who has created the stars and he has put them there in the heavens. Psalm 147:4 says, he counts the numbers of the stars. He calls them all by name. So it's not random. It's not a haphazard creation of the stars. They are specific and they are placed in certain places intentionally by God. Job chapter 38, verses 31 through 33 says, can you bind the cluster of the Pleiades or loose the belt of Orion? Can you bring out Maseroth in its season? Or can you guide the great bear with its cubs? Do you know the ordinances of the heavens? Can you set their dominion over the earth? Now this is God's confrontation with Job. Job has kind of been complaining about his plight. And at the end, God finally reveals himself to Job. And he says, Who are you to complain against me? I'm paraphrasing here. Can you do this? And did you do this? And do you know about this? And he just goes on for two chapters. And this is part of that. Can you bind the stars or loose them? Or, in other words, he can't. Job is small, but God is the creator of them. And he is in charge and he is in control of it all. So it's, again, just an affirmation of God's greatness. Going back to Genesis chapter 1, verses 14 and 15, says, God said, let there be lights in the firmament of the heaven to divide the day from the night, and let them be for signs and seasons and for days and years, and let them be for lights in the firmament of the heavens to give light on the earth. And it was so. The key part here is, let them be for signs and seasons. And normally we'll look at the stars and, you know, we determine our seasons and our days and all of that by the movement of the heavenly bodies and our position in relationship to them. But what if the position of the stars and the way they have moved and come together and the planets point to greater things than just our day and night and months and all of those kinds of things? And maybe this is what the Magi saw, these wise men in the east, having studied astrology, looking up to the stars of the sky, and they see something that points them to the birth of the King of the Jews, the King of the world. And so I think that there's this connection going all the way back to Daniel that God had maintained so that at the appropriate time, at the birth of Jesus, they would see the sign of the birth of the King of the Jews in the stars, and they would make their trek to worship him in Israel. It's a great thing. Now, the second possibility here, and let me just say my opinion, and I can't be dogmatic, is that when they saw the star the first time, that's what they saw. They studied the stars, and they saw something there the first time. Now, the other option is that the star is not the stars of the sky, but some kind of angel. So, angels and stars are often associated together in Revelation chapter 1, verse 20. This is just one of the verses, many verses that we could go to in the Old Testament and the New Testament. John has seen this vision, and there's this candlestick, and there's seven stars, and Jesus is just given a brief explanation of what each element is. So it says in 120 of Revelation, the mystery of the seven stars, which you saw in my right hand, and the seven golden lampstands. The seven stars are the angels of the seven churches. And the seven lampstands, which you saw, are the seven churches. So this is one verse in which stars and angels are associated with each other, and it would not have been a stretch to anyone reading this verse to associate stars with angels, because it is just a common thing in Scripture. Now, the reason that I think the second time they see the star, that it's more than just something in the heavens, because it says in verse 9, when they heard the king, they departed, and behold, the star which they had seen in the east went before them, till it came and stood over where the young child was. Now, I don't know how any star of the heaven or anything, just, you don't even have to go very far up, can point or direct to a particular spot on the earth. So I think at this point, when they see the star, that is moving them towards the particular place where Jesus is, that here there is some kind of manifestation, some kind of angelic manifestation as a star or a light in the sky that is leading them there. So they see the star, they rejoice with exceeding great joy when they had come to the house. Wait a minute, there's another. Yeah, verse 9. The star which they had seen in the east went before them, till it came and stood over where the young child was. When they saw the star, they rejoiced with exceeding great joy. And when they had come to the house, they saw the young child with Mary, his mother. Why did they rejoice when they see the star? Because it was the star that directed them to where the baby was born. And in other words, when they left, they were not constantly seeing the star. They see it, and they make their way to Jerusalem. When they come to Jerusalem, and it, you know, comes time to find the child, then they see it again. It appears a second time. And this time it directs them right to where the baby was. All right, any questions about the star? So in other words, the first appearance, I think it's the heavenly bodies that they see. The second occurrence, I think it's maybe more of an angelic manifestation. So I kind of go with both, depending on, you know, at which point we're talking about. So again, I can't be dogmatic about that, but that just kind of seems to be the progression here. All right, any questions or comments? Anybody? Okay. All right, that brings us to our final point, Herod the Wicked. Now, when the wise men come and they're asking for the birth of the King of the Jews, let's go back to verse 3. When Herod the king heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. And when he had gathered all the chief priests and scribes of the people together, he inquired of them where the, what? Where the Christ, the Messiah, was to be born. Now, what that tells us is that the request of the Magi to find the king of the Jews is not hidden. They're not just asking for a king like Herod. They're asking for the king, the Messiah. Where is he going to be born? And Herod knows this, because he calls his scholars, his Old Testament scholars, and he says, where is the Messiah to be born? He knew who they were looking for. It was clear. It was not hidden. And when they reply, they turn to prophecies concerning the birth of the Messiah in Bethlehem. So the quote here is from Bethlehem. So there's no secret about this. The Magi have come looking for the Messiah of the world. And Herod knew it. Herod knew it. And he still rejects. And he doesn't just reject a little. It is a wholesale rejection of the Messiah, a wholesale rejection of God. He is not ignorant. He is outright rebellious. It is a shaking of his fist against the God, the creator of the universe. He wants nothing to do with him. He is deceptive. He feigns interest. He says to the wise men, go find him so that I might worship him also. But his intent is not to worship at all. His intent is to kill all the children 2 years old and younger. And issuing a decree to kill children 2 years old and under is demonic. That is evil. That is wicked. There is no more wicked act than that. It shows that he is of the devil, and the devil is using him in order to attempt to destroy the Messiah. I mean, just think, the world has responded in an uproar when Hamas went into Israel and took 250 people hostages, including women and children. And besides the hostages that they took, the women and the children, they also killed innocent families, men, women, and children. They killed them. And even to the world that does not believe, that is a heinous crime. And here is this king who issues a decree to kill all the children in a city 2 years old and under. Every time I think about it, it's just demonic. It is evil. It is a wicked act on the part of Herod. So Herod the Wicked, that's how I call him. Not Herod the Great. He's Herod the Wicked. All right. Any questions about Herod? Of course, Joseph is warned. They flee. They're not in any danger. They go down to Egypt. They stay there until all these people are dead. Herod's dead, and I think one of his sons especially. And then God tells Joseph and Mary and Jesus to come on back, and they go to Nazareth. And that's where he's raised until he begins his ministry in Nazareth. All right? Any comments on that or questions? Any thoughts? Okay. That's my...